Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Welcome to Our Shelves, a podcast where writers from the legendary feminist publishing house Virago talk about their cultural worlds. We'll be diving into these writers' bookshelves, record collections, and recollections to discover what inspires them. I'm Lucy Scholes, and my guest today is Audrey Osler. Welcome to Our Shelves, Audrey. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's very exciting to be here. Thank you.
So Audrey is Professor Emerita of Citizenship and Human Rights Education at the University of Leeds. She is widely known for her research on teachers' lives and careers, children's rights and racial justice, and has worked as an educator in many countries, predominantly in Europe, East Asia and North America. She has acted as an expert advisor for the Council of Europe, UNESCO and a range of national governments. Her books have been translated into many languages, including Japanese and Chinese. Her latest work, Where Are You From? No, Where Are You Really From? Is published by Virago this autumn. So Audrey, I want to start by asking you a little bit about your new book. I wouldn't strictly describe it as a memoir, but it does tell a very personal story, a sort of narrative of your family history that spans seven different generations, three centuries, and geographically speaking, much of the globe too. I wonder if you could begin by telling our listeners a little bit about why and then how you decided to set about tracking these ancestors down and telling their stories.
Sure. Well, I think everyone is familiar with the question, where are you from? Mm. But people of colour today still are getting, all too often, I think, the follow-up question, no, where are you really from?
Yeah.
So I wanted to explore my own history on my own terms and to answer this question for myself in relation to my family. And at a personal level, there were a couple of things in my family history. My maternal family originates in Madras in southern India. Things in my family history that I really wanted to explore, in particular, two puzzles that I wanted to resolve and research. The first story was that when my mother boarded the ship to come to the UK from Singapore in 1949, her father told her that they had a relative buried in St. Paul's Cathedral in London. And this seems such an unlikely thing. My brother said, oh, they're all confused, you know.
Yeah.
Such an unlikely thing that we would have such a connection, you know, given that the cathedral houses famous and great names, you know, Christopher Wren, the architect, writer, great poets and so on. It seemed most unlikely, but it needed checking out. And ours was a modest family from Madras in southern India, so it almost seemed impossible that this could be true. But we eventually worked out who this might be, and it was Frederick Roberts, Earl of Kandahar, Pretoria and Waterford, who died in 1914. So my grandfather would have remembered this event of him dying because he was at a state funeral, but it still seemed unlikely, and we still couldn't make the link. So this was one mystery that I wanted to research and resolve. And then there was a second mystery, really, and that was that my family was said to own the Unitarian Church in Chennai, but an ancestor had founded it. And like, I had no idea who this was and how he discovered and taken Unitarianism from Europe, you know, this progressive, rational, new way of looking at things in the 18th century, and how he possibly introduced that into 18th and early 19th century India. So that was the second story that I wanted to uncover.
It's sort of fascinating because you say you came from a very modest family, but you have actually got this incredible, once you started looking into it, there are some incredible kind of historical events that your family were obviously sort of involved in, things that they did. I mean, were you, how much of what you were coming across was a kind of great surprise to you and a great sort of excitement?
I think everything past my own mother's life, really, because I went to Chennai, I think it was 2018, shortly before the pandemic, and I was hoping to go back. But I went there completely unprepared, I was fortunate enough to be able to stay for a weekend on my way to Sri Lanka, but I knew nothing. I didn't know what to expect in the city. All I knew was that my family had been Anglicans. So I just went off to the oldest Anglican church in the city and started asking questions. But I really didn't know what I was doing. I had to spend a lot of time doing a lot of research in archives and so on much later on.
Yeah, it must have been a kind of strange. Is this the most sort of personal project you ever worked on?
Probably, yes. Mm. I think, yes, almost certainly. I've just finished doing the audiobook, and when I was reading it out loud, in a way that I hadn't seen when I was just reading it to myself or checking my scripts or whatever, I realised that how much personal stuff there is in there. It is quite personal.
I think also one of the things I found really fascinating about it, and I think you make this point in it, that a lot of us maybe have an idea that the sort of Windrush generation, that influx of British citizens from the British Empire in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, is sort of the time that large amounts of people of colour first arrived in the country. But as your own research shows, this is not the case. I mean, you're tracing a family back way before that, that has these kind of lines that crisscross across the British Empire, right?
Absolutely. And I was aware that the two earlier generations of my family, my mother and my grandparents, had been migrants. And I really thought it would be interesting to explore their physical journeys. And I had to do this during lockdown when I was grounded, really. I was at home. So I couldn't even leave my home, let alone travel the world. And I'd visited Chennai in India. I'd visited Singapore as a child and as an adult, but I'd never been to Sarawak in East Malaysia, the places they'd lived. So finding out, and I'd really hoped to do this as well as part of the book, and I wasn't able to go there in the end. But I think it's really, really important in 21st century Britain and Europe, when there's so much intolerance within sections of society about migrants. I really wanted to explore what it meant to be a migrant, and actually what I uncovered was that every single generation of my family back to the late 18th century had in fact been a migrant of some sort.
That's incredible, really. One of the things that came out to me, particularly in the book, that I wanted to talk about a little bit, was this push and pull of identification and exclusion, that it seems that in every generation that you're writing about, there's this sense of these British citizens, these people who are, they're told they're British citizens to a certain extent, but only on the terms that then, white British citizens want them to be. So they come, and I think we're aware of that maybe with the Windrush generation. We've read stories about people coming to the UK and thinking that they're going to be welcomed, with open arms, and actually having the exact opposite circumstances. But this is going way back in your research. I feel like you're encountering this over and over again. And that must have been quite, I don't know, I'd love to know a little bit about how that sort of, the emotional sort of toll that takes on you learning about this and having to explore these stories.
Yes, it was an emotional, there were many, many emotional moments in researching this book. Definitely. The first time I found a letter from my three times great grandfather was extremely moving. He had written that letter, I think, in 1831. He'd sent it to London to people he didn't know, He'd sent it with a copy, a second copy, to London because he wasn't convinced that they would actually receive the first. He must have also kept the third copy himself because that's what people had to do in those days. So the thing I wanted to get to grips with was why and how this empire influenced people's lives. And clearly in my family, probably from the early 19th century, they were encouraged to think of themselves as British. They were actually taught Britishness. We hear a lot about learning Britishness at school today. They were taught Britishness at school, that this was their life. I do recall my own uncle being able to recite the counties of England as they were in the 1930s.
Wow.
When I met him in the 1980s, and I thought, what is all this about, this education? So the other thing is that this is about empire, isn't it? It's become a very contentious subject recently, and some people just want a simple heroic story, and they want to make that story far removed from serious historical research. And you have to think about why this is, and I guess it's because a lot of us have never ever had the chance to really study this, so they're easily swayed, or people of all different backgrounds are easily swayed as to what the empire was about. I mean, I studied history at school and at university, and yet I knew next to nothing about the British Empire, and I've learned an awful lot from researching this book. But what I do understand from that initial training as a historian is that about any aspect of history, that it's multifaceted, that the original sources generally include propaganda and disinformation. So I think, I think that this was what I was thinking about and learning as I went along. And this applies to empire as much to any other aspect of history. So it's not surprising, really, that people were encouraged to think of themselves as being part of something for the purposes of ruling a country or accessing its wealth or whatever. And then they find the reality, when they come face to face with it, isn't quite the same as they expected, as indeed that Windrush generation did. But I think other generations earlier in history, Anglo-Indians, my family were of mixed descent, and there were Anglo-Indians petitioning Parliament in the 19th century, demanding rights to be respected, and expecting Parliament to take them seriously. They weren't often successful, but they were turning up and making their pleas. So what I'm trying to do in the book, I think, is to look at empire through the lives of one family, as you said, across 6-7 generations, and to think, well, this is my family history, so I've been super meticulous and as accurate as I can be, and I've tried to test the family stories against the established facts, and then check out the established facts and where are they coming from. So I've had to go back to archives. I've hung around a lot in the British Library at Pancras. And yes, this is a story of my ancestors. This is a story of people. They include those I know and love, but to try and understand their motivations and their context, I've had to dig into other people's research. I remember being asked, like, why do you think your mother was able to leave her family and come to England in 1949? Was it just love, or were there other pressures on her? And when I thought hard about it, I realised, well, yes, she just survived. She was living in Singapore. She'd come through a period of occupation. She'd really suffered and seen suffering in World War II, and so probably As well as falling in love and making a new start, she probably felt that being in England would be a way of putting the past behind her, I'm guessing.
Yeah, no, I can completely understand that. And I think it's so fascinating listening to you talk about, you know, the uncovering of the personal stories, because I think what I felt reading this book particularly is that, you know, I'm very aware that over the last few years, there's been quite a lot of, or there's at least the beginning of quite a lot of work being done about historians, writers, you know, people are really trying to wrangle with the complexities and the cruelties of the British Empire in quite a big way. You know, books like Satnam Sangera's Empire Land have been so important, which you reference in the beginning of your book. And they're opening up this conversation, and that broader picture is so important. But actually, when you drill it down into something like a single family like yours, and they're able to trace these narratives and see how, on a very kind of detailed, you know, minor stage in terms of the complexities of these individual relationships, how it affects people's lives, I think personally it opens up a whole new way of that I can sort of experience it and understand this as well.
Well, I really, really enjoyed reading Sangera's book Empire Land, but the thing that hit me about it was that it was mostly about men and their lives. And in my book, by taking it from a family perspective, it wasn't easy to find out about women's lives. I think I knew that everyone in my family would see the story differently. My mother or grandmother, even my cousins or my brother today would see these things slightly differently. But when you talk about understanding history through a family, I think what I've got is a fresh take on empire, because it's history from the grassroots. It's from family life. It's not a story of armies and battles, although that I'm quite shocked at how much military stuff crops up in the book. But it's not even it's not even about plunder and loot. Clearly all that were going on, but it's also about how people were negotiating, navigating these difficult things that they were facing, the solutions they found when life became too difficult in one place, what they had to do about it.
Yeah, I think so. And also just, you know, the idea of, like you say about, you know, your mother making the choice to move somewhere because of love, and how that affects you, and these sort of these very, you know, these major decisions in one's life, but they're not because some great she hasn't been told to do this, but you know that, and then the shifts that happen after that. And I found it I found it really moving. I thought it eye-opening, moving, beautifully written. So I can only recommend it to our listeners to get hold of a copy of their own. Thank you for sharing so much about it. I'm going to move into some of our main questions now, if I may, Audrey, and ask you a little bit to begin with about what is currently on your bedside table. What books are you reading at the moment or about to read?
Well, one that I've just finished is The Night Tiger by Yangtze Chu. And I chose this book, was attracted to this book as it's also set in a period of history that I've been researching. So it's set in 1930s Malaya, modern day Malaysia, in an era I was researching for my own book, when Malaya was part of the British Empire. But it goes to places that my book doesn't go to, like it goes to the dance halls of Ipoh in northern Malaya. It explores a relatively remote valley, and this novel is really attractive to me because it has two very engaging young characters. There's very very impulsive Jin Lee, who's a young woman who's having to take terrible risks to pay off her mother's debts, and then there's a boy, Ren, a much younger boy I think, who works as a houseboy, and they're both caught up with what's going on around them, including Ren's employers, who was a doctor, beliefs, superstitions and fears. And he's trying to find the doctor's lost finger. And so he really hopes that if he can discover this finger, that the man's spirit can be at peace and not have to wander the earth for eternity. Now, I don't normally choose magical books, but this is a really nice book because it combines the magical with the the modern and the very hard everyday lives of people who are working in a dressmaker's shop or working as businessmen, lonely. It's intriguing. It's an intriguing insight into a lost world of the past.
You make it sound absolutely fascinating. I'm interested a bit more broadly. You mentioned that obviously it's it sort of covers some of the period that you were researching. How useful have you found, particularly, I guess, when you were writing Where Are You From? Where Are You Really From? How useful did you find novels and fiction when you were doing research? Or did you try to stick mostly to more factual evidence?
I stuck to factual evidence and archives, but I had to try and picture these places from the past. And, you know, 1930s Malaya, I had to try and imagine 1930s Singapore, the smells, the feelings. So I tried to look for novels. But there are kind of gaps also in what people write about. This book that I found, Chu's book, The Night Tiger, I think there aren't many books like this written in English. I don't know of other books about 1930s Malaya. So I didn't discover it actually until after I'd finished my writing. But it's these kinds of things I was always looking for, just to build up images in my head of where people were and how they were experiencing things. You know, the heat, the smells, the food.
Yeah.
I tried to look to literature to find those kinds of things, and then to look to archives to check out facts and propaganda. I even looked in the British Library. There's something fabulous called Thacker's Directory, and it's like old-fashioned Google Maps. So these are huge, huge, big directories, like old-fashioned telephone directories, and they try and list everybody in the European community in India any one year.
Wow.
Yeah. And they give also advertisements about, you know, where you can get your horse dealt with, or whatever people do with horses, or I'm not expert in that area, you know, how you're going to travel from one place to another. So if you want to travel, let's say, from Delhi and go to the far northwest of India, it explains how you'll go about it. Well, you'll before trains, you know, you'll take a bullock cart to this place, and then you should stop at this other place and ask the way, and eventually you know, it explains detail by detail how you make your journey, clearly for European administrators or people, business people who needed to move around the country. It's really fascinating.
How wonderful. Yeah. That sort of level of detail is so useful, because you can then really picture and sort of evokes the details of the life, right, that you might not be able to find on just reading some other archival sources. Wow, I sort of want to go and check those out myself now. Next time in the British Library, I'll have a look. Oh gosh. What's the second book that is on your bedside table, please?
Yeah, so the second book is rather a different book. I love Elif Shafak, and I've read I've read a few of her novels, Three Daughters of Eve, 10 Minutes 38 Seconds in This Strange World, The Island of Missing Trees. But the book I chose is How to Stay Sane in an Age of Division. It was published about 3 years ago. And what she's doing is focusing on the power of stories to bring us together. And she discusses how listening to each other can nurture democracy, empathy, and our faith in a kinder and wiser future. And basically, I think it's a very generous and open-hearted book. And it reveals some of Shafak's skills as a storyteller, because she combines stories with political discussion and her training as a political theorist. And yeah, it was the kind of book that I would be so proud if I'd written. It's very slim. It isn't very elegant, 90-page volume. But she's looking at the anxieties of the world, and it's so easy for any of us to whinge, to complain, to reflect on the overwhelming injustice or what feels like endless crises. But what she's trying to do is to talk about how stories and how listening to others can actually change that. And she has kind of practical ideas for how you deal with people who feel increasingly left out and how you bring people together through giving them space to tell their stories. So I think that's very, very moving. And she was writing at the time, I think, when George Floyd was murdered, and she's cautioning against anger, as you know, she recognises that people might feel very, very angry. Now, she doesn't reference Floyd, as far as I can remember, his murder, but she's saying, you know, it's a useful short-term emotion, but we need other emotions to deal with injustice. I think she quotes Toni Morrison saying, "I get angry about things, then go on and work, you know, get things done." So I really, really find it a very, not just a moving book, but a kind of guide, if you like, on a reminder of how we sit in echo chambers, but actually we need to practice a lot more listening and telling of stories. She does that through telling stories of her own childhood, learning to write, all kinds of personal stories that she brings it alive with.
How wonderful. It sounds very, also sounds quite hopeful in a world which, like you say, is often I think people find themselves overwhelmed by the injustices and the sort of, you know, the horrors that are going on. And it's very hard to manage to carve out space in that to have some sort of more sort of positive thought or hope toward the future. So this sounds like it could be a good read for many of us right now. Thank you. And next up, I have asked you to recommend a recent film or podcast or TV show, something that you've been watching or reading that's made you think. And I think you've got a film for us, haven't you, this week?
Yes. Well, I'm lucky enough to live near a fabulous independent cinema and arts centre, Phoenix in Leicester, so I can really indulge my passion for international cinema. And the film I've chosen is Paris Memories, Paris Revoir, directed by Alice Vanacour. And it's a film, it's a story of what happens to a survivor of a fictional Paris cafe terror attack. Now, it's not a gory film or a horrible film. I don't normally go and see films that have too much violence.
I don't either, so I'm with you on that.
So she's telling the story of one survivor, and it's quite a lot like the Bataclan attacks in 2015 in Paris on the bars and restaurants. And she's looking at how one person, character Mia, played by Virginie Efira, survives. And Mia is a 40-something woman living in a rather comfortable middle-class existence with her partner. And she follows Mia's inner journey after she's caught up just by chance and in an attack as she tries to piece together her memory. So the title in French, Paris Revoir, is to see Paris again. It's also how she uncovers a different side to the city she lived in after the events, how she sees Paris through new eyes. I really liked it because one thing Mia does is eventually recall that she's been hiding during the attack with a Senegalese kitchen worker. It's really, really important to her to try and track him down and see if he's still alive. So she's very driven, and she goes looking in places in Paris that she wouldn't normally go to talking to people she wouldn't normally see, and on her motorbike. And she uncovers a very different Paris, probably a Paris that most filmgoers don't see. She goes and talks to migrants who are undocumented, And that's why she's finding it so hard to find him, because this particular survivor hasn't hung around to be looked after by the police. He's made a getaway because he hasn't got papers. It's not touristic in any way, but she reveals how the attack changes someone's life forever. She sees her surroundings and her city in a new light. And it's very carefully constructed, a moving film, as one survivor seeks to piece together her own memory and look at life differently. So I think it's a fabulous film. I'd recommend to anyone.
I'm interested, was it a film that you went to watch or went to see because you already had in mind that it would appeal to your sort of interests, or did you just go and see it because it's on at your wonderful local cinema and then discovered it that way?
I think I don't just go and see any old film at my local cinema, but
I'm sure they have a very select, you know, I'm trying to be polite about their what they're showing as well here.
I went to see it because I try and listen to films in French to keep my language skills going. But it's one of the reasons. But I'm not very keen on all these French films that are very that are sponsored by a particular tourist board of a particular part of France. And I went to see this one because I thought the subject of terror, looking at this kind of issue, is another issue that divides people and makes people angry. And I like the idea of exploring how you recover from something like this in on a personal level. And I think I've not seen another film like it. And I've had the privilege, I think, in my career to work in a lot of post-conflict countries. So I've come across many people who've undergone different kinds of horrors in their lives. And it was interesting to see how the director tried to deal with the question of putting a memory together, facing the past, putting your life together after something awful has happened.
Arshel will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Our Shelves. I'm Lucy Scholes, and I've just been talking to Audrey Osler about a brilliant film called Paris Memories. Next up then, Audrey, I'm going to ask you to tell me about a book that has made you think about feminism in a new way.
This one was really difficult for me to choose.
Yeah. We do like to make our guests work hard for these final few questions, I must admit.
Right. I chose Zami, A New Spelling of My Name by Audre Lorde. The reason I chose it, well, I was probably first drawn to this book when I came across it when I was living in Seattle, and I knew nothing about Audre Lorde. I had no idea who she might be. I probably picked it up because of her name, you know, having the same name as myself. And probably Lorde is best known for her poems, but I've always been drawn to novels before poetry, so I'd never come across her poetry. And this is a very, very interesting book to me because it's presented as a novel when people talk about it, but it's also a biography, and I've always been interested in life histories. And I like the way Lorde combines history and myth and stories and biography, and she doesn't really stick to any established form, and I really like that too. She documents her life as a young girl in Harlem in New York City, and then she goes on to show how she finds her way through life as a Black lesbian. And I love the way that she describes her childhood. And I think when I read this book, it made me realize that there are many different ways of being a feminist. And at that point, I think I'd been working in the university, and I think the British academic feminist scholars, education scholars, I should say, that I'd come across at that point some of whom I'd probably found a bit exclusive, I kind of realised that they didn't have the last word on feminism.
Yeah, that's a lovely way of putting it. Very polite.
And it's not that I hadn't read really interesting work by feminist historians and so on. I had, but I think I'd been worn down a bit by working in the university and some of the jobs I'd done before that, that made me feel that I had to work too hard to belong. And I think Audre Lorde, although her life and is and her identities are very different in many ways from my own, I think she simply reminded me that feminism and fun were not mutually exclusive.
How wonderful, how wonderful. I also wonder, from what you're talking about, what you've just said about the book, it strikes me that, do you think there was an element of fun, I suppose actually fun is a perfect word, it's an element of sort of fun and excitement and sort of an idea of breaking through boundaries in the way that the novel or this kind of strange book is structured. Like you say, it's a mixture of kind of, you know, fiction, mythology, biography, all these things. That must, I imagine, have been quite an exciting book to encounter, perhaps after reading more dry academic feminist texts, maybe.
Absolutely. And, you know, also she's very, very honest. She doesn't seem to have so many pretensions about herself. You know, she enters an affair and it's quite clear that she's not really sure how she should behave towards a potential partner. And I just think that's very, very open. And I think I'm probably quite a private person, actually. And I like the way that she's opened herself up to her readers.
Can I just ask, this was published, I think, in 1982. When did you first read it, just out of interest? Were you quite young at the time, or was it more recently?
I think it was probably around the early 2000s, like okay. when I was totally oppressed by working in a university.
A dark period you don't want to talk about. Fair enough. Let's move swiftly on in that case then. Next up, could you tell me about a woman or a person of an unrepresented gender whom you particularly admire? And again, I know this is a tricky question, making you choose just one person.
Yeah, well, I think the notes I received said somebody you put on a pedestal, and
yes.
And I don't think that I try and avoid putting people on a pedestal. So I've chosen somebody who's no longer alive. And I've chosen Georgia O'Keeffe. And I admire her for her very, very independent spirit as an artist and for her single-mindedness as well as for her work. And when I was thinking about this podcast, I was really thinking, I don't want to focus on words, words, words. And so looking at art seemed to be a different way of approaching things. So I like Georgia O'Keeffe's life in that she more or less knew what she wanted to do from when she was leaving high school. And she just went about it and did it her own way. She was a trained artist, but she didn't fit into any conventional artist movement of her time. And I think probably when she was probably not so well known in Britain at first, she became very quickly known in the United States, where she was from. She was probably acknowledged, I think, in the mid-1920s, when she was only in her 30s, she achieved success. But that didn't seem to kind of cause her to go off track, or, you know, she stayed with her art and she did exactly what she wanted to do. And she's probably best known for her radical depictions of flowers. But her work is very bright and so on. And I also came across her when I was traveling So I think when I'm traveling, I often come across people or have a chance to look at art or experience places in a fresh way. So I came across her when I visited Santa Fe in New Mexico nearly 20 years ago. And I think it was probably the first time I'd ever come across a museum dedicated to a sole female artist. And I got to visit her studio. So it's that very personal opportunity that made me kind of delve into her work. And I love her work because it's bright and bold.
Yeah, how wonderful. And I think you're right. It's actually quite rare to find an artist who has an entire museum dedicated to them, let alone a female artist in that position, right?
Yeah, I think so. I like what she said. She said, I have to create an equivalent for what I felt about what I was looking at, not copy it. She went her own way, even when she was in her 90s and her eyesight was failing. She worked with assistants and she just kept going. She said, I can see what I want to paint. So she kind of worked with assistants to go on creating work right through 7 decades of her life.
It's incredible. And I think, you know, there's something very important there as well. Like you say, that there was no moment at which she sort of went off the rails or off track. She just worked very sort of, you know, diligently and consistently at her artwork. And I think I fall into this trap myself sometimes, but I get very distracted sometimes by the tumultuous lives of certain writers or artists. Mm. And actually finding somebody who is dedicated to their craft and sort of pursues it like that is a rare and quite wonderful sort of calm sort of thing to encounter, let's say.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's what makes her special.
Wonderful, making me want to go and look at some more of her work. And last up today then, Audrey, if I can ask you, what is your golden apple that is the Virago book that you would most regularly recommend to others? And again, I know, tricky question, but you've got a really good answer for me, I think.
I've chosen Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston. And I definitely recommend Hurston's work and that book to anyone. It was first published in 1937, I think, and was lost and largely forgotten. I think Hurston died poor and unrecognised. But I think that also goes back in my own history, because I think Virago published it in the 1980s. And I think that was a period when I first began enjoying so many Virago books. And
wonderful.
So it's been beautifully republished by Virago quite recently. It's a very poetic, lyrical novel. And I can't imagine how she managed to do it in, I think it was 7 weeks that she wrote it. You know, to write such a lovely book in 7 weeks. It's a story of Janie, who's searching for an ideal love, and she's first married off to an old man, and he thinks he treats her well because he treats her better than his mule. She then
pretty low standards.
She then runs off and marries another man who treats her as an accessory in his ambitions to be a mayor and someone of importance in a black-run town. And eventually she runs off with this guy called Tea Cake, and everyone thinks that she's very foolish because by this time her second husband has died, and so she's quite a well-off widow, and they think that he's after her money. And what I like about it is like it's the way it begins. She's telling a story to her friend, the love that she finds is like not necessarily the love that anyone else would choose. It's very imperfect. They have fights, they have struggles, but this individual that she finds wants to know and understand and take care of her in the way that she wants. There's also a very, very interesting account. They face a hurricane in the Everglades. And it sounds very lurid, but it's not. Her partner, Tea Cake, gets bitten by a dog while trying to save her, and he contracts rabies and goes mad. And as at the end, she ends up having to shoot him in order to spare her own life and gets charged with murder. It sounds really lurid, but it's not. And when I read those scenes about the hurricane, I couldn't help but think of the images of destruction that I saw in Aceh in Indonesia after the tsunami. The tsunami happened in 2004, and I went 9 months later, and you could see the destruction everywhere around you. But the stories the survivors told me have stayed with me all these years. And when I reread Hurston, I realized how she was able to capture people's horrors and portray them in a powerful way. And this is a story about a woman who may not make the choices in love that the reader might hope she might choose, but she definitely finds what she's looking for, and she faces life on her own terms. And I think that's a great, great book.
How beautifully put. I think that is the perfect place to end this episode. Audrey, thank you so much for sharing such wonderful recommendations with us and talking about your book. It's been a real pleasure to have you on the show today.
Thank you very much for having me. I felt very honoured to be asked.
That's wonderful. Thank you everyone else for listening to Our Shelves, which is brought to you by the team at Virago Press. Special thanks to today's guest, Audrey Osler, and tune in next time for more conversation about books, feminism, and culture.